So welcome back, everyone. How many people experienced impermanent walking? How many people had some impermanent food? Impermanent tastes? Impermanent sensations? Anyone have those? I hope so. It's a good sign of life. So we'll do a short meditation to continue that focus on impermanence. So I think I'll invite first just a very brief experience of what I was calling the reflection on more gross impermanence. Here, just take, we'll take 3 or 4 minutes and just reflect in a very ordinary way about things changing. You know, the seasons are changing, or I went outside just now, I have a plum tree, and the plums are starting to turn red. Just notice impermanence in a very common, ordinary way, things are changing with the virus, or reflect on the ups and downs of public figures, or and include your own sense of the impermanence of yourself. So just about 3 minutes now, just to reflect in that way. It's not mindfulness practice, it's just reflecting with your thoughts. And now let's go back to being with impermanence through one sense, We'll go back to being with the impermanent flow of phenomena through body sensations. And again, there are a few ways to do that. We could just be with the breath. We could focus on the breath wherever we attend to the breath and notice the changing sensations. Again, it can be helpful to very quietly just name arising, passing, or just maybe stay with and periodically say changing and just tune in to how it's changing. We could also again be with the hands touching together, noticing the sensations, or being with the whole body or some part of the body, noticing sensations. We'll just do that for a few more minutes. So again, these are some of the ways of cultivating insight into impermanence. Impermanence is not, in its basics, a conceptually difficult teaching. You know, we'll see later when we look at anatta or not self that that can be conceptually confusing. But impermanence is fairly straightforward. It's more a matter of giving attention to impermanence and doing so over time. That's really crucial. That the insight comes especially in continuing to look at impermanence, at bring, you know, something like this very simple practice. And again, it can be quite powerful sometimes to do it for, you know, a few hours in a row or half a day or a day, or do it at a retreat. It can shift your perspective. And again, the working with the more reflective dimension of it can also be transformative. Did anyone reflect on your own impermanence? Anyone do that? Anyone? I mean, I did it. I noticed I reflected on my own impermanence. And when I did that, there was something like a, oh. Now, there was like a, oh. Oh, I don't always remember that, right? So anyone relate to that? Right, that it's it can be powerful in that way, done over and over again. And again, part of the intention of reflecting on impermanence or doing the impermanence practice is to develop a sense of urgency and a sense of clarity about what's most important. So it can lead in that direction. And again, there are some other ways of practicing with impermanence that if we had the whole day on it, we might do. I think Liz brought out, we can focus on emotions. We can you can start to bring in a sense of how something can be pleasant, and over time it changes to unpleasant. Something can be unpleasant, over time it changes to neutral or pleasant. We can also explore the challenges of being with impermanence with the sense of vision or sight. That vision of our senses in the Western sense of the five senses is the most connected with conceptualization. So if you try to be with impermanence with your eyes open and focusing on the sense of sight, you'll find it generally quite a bit harder. You can even try it right now. When we just are with sense phenomena, we will tend to go to conceptualization. You can just look around your space you're in now. Just look for a little while. And it's not easy just to be with the sense data of sight. How many people notice doing that and already finding concepts coming up pretty quickly, right? That's generally what would happen. So we can try that, but just to know that that's harder. We don't have conceptualization so connected with body sensations or a sense of sound or taste or smell. We have some, but not very many. And also, one thing that's another practice that I never read about it, but I just ended up doing it myself when I was doing a fair amount of metta practice, because I think I probably have talked about it sometimes, but when I do retreats, I often, when I'm in the dining hall at retreats, for example, at Spirit Rock, will do metta practice, and I'll do it by going from one person to another and doing metta for like four phrases going on to the next person. And one time when I was doing a lot of impermanence practice, I did metta practice with a sense of impermanence. This is an impermanent being, and bringing impermanence to mind, and then doing loving kindness practice. We could also do compassion. And you might want to try that. I found it very interesting to do that over a number of days. Just being with every being. You go out in a public space, or you know, if you take a walk, and bring a sense of realization of the impermanence of every being. We could do it looking at gallery view on Zoom right now, go from one to the other. You know, I'm not going to do that right now, but we could, right? We could bring impermanence into metta practice. So I want to turn now to our second of our three ways of seeing that liberate, which is the sense of looking into dukkha. And I think in the way that dukkha is understood in tradition and in the West, there can be some confusion about what it means. I'm going to talk about there being several meanings of dukkha, and I'm thinking that the central meaning of dukkha for our practice is reactivity, which is not a literal translation, but I think it makes sense. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that, and I'm going to do so particularly in the context of really, I think, what is the fundamental aim of practice, which is, as the Buddha once said, to end dukkha. That's how it's expressed in the Four Noble Truths, and that's how it's expressed in other teachings. The end of all our practice is to end dukkha, or the purpose of all our practice is to end dukkha. I like to express that in very ordinary English as saying that we transform the many forms of reactivity that are there in our habits and our conditioning, we transform reactivity into responsiveness. I think that is a very ordinary English way of talking about the core teaching of this 2,600-year tradition. That's it. Reactivity to responsiveness. No need for further books, right? Just understand that and practice that in all the different dimensions, and I think we're actualizing our Buddha nature, so to speak. Now, as is often said, something can be conceptually simple and practically and experientially hard. I would say that this is the case here. Conceptually easy. Reactivity to responsiveness. Practically not easy. Okay? But let me say a little bit more about the meaning of dukkha, because there are multiple meanings in the discourses of the Buddha. And that's why it can be quite confusing. And I say the usual translation is suffering, sometimes unsatisfactoriness. And I don't think these get at the core meaning of dukkha. You know, so generally on my reading of the discourses of the Buddha, there are at least four core meanings of the word dukkha. One of the reasons there can be some confusion. The first meaning is quite common, and this is where I'll actually read a passage where the Buddha says, this is how he explains the first noble truth of dukkha. What is the noble truth of dukkha? Birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, death is dukkha, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are dukkha. Not to obtain what one wants is dukkha. In short, the five aggregates affected by clinging are dukkha. And so there the Buddha is really giving a sense of the dukkha as what is unpleasant. You know, he's saying that when there is birth, there is the unpleasant. Not getting what you want is dukkha. Not getting what you don't want. This is unpleasant, and this is probably the main meaning in the original etymology. Dukkha is unpleasant, because that's actually the way the word was used, and the etymology has to do with an axle in a cart being off-center, and it's the way that it sits into the groove so that there's a bumpy ride. And so here, dukkha means basically the unpleasant. But if we ask, what does the end of dukkha mean? It doesn't mean, as far as we know, when we look to the Buddha's awakening, it doesn't mean the end of the unpleasant. The unpleasant keeps happening. The Buddha was awake, and he had headaches and backaches at times when he was older, right? So presumably, that wasn't an issue, you know? And so the end of dukkha doesn't mean the end of the unpleasant. I would say it means a different relationship to the unpleasant. In other words, and that's where I'm getting at non-reactivity. And there's a similar way that a second meaning of dukkha that we have in the traditions is about how there will be change and what was once pleasant will become unpleasant. This is called viparinama dukkha. The first sense of dukkha is called dukkha-dukkha. The second sense is called viparinama. It's about how nothing will stay pleasant. Everything will change. And again, this can be something that leads to reactivity, but if we ask the question, when there's no more dukkha, does that change? No. Even when we're awakened, as the Buddha was, the pleasant will still sometimes change to the unpleasant. The Buddha will still be sitting there fully awake, feeling good, and a headache will come on. And so the second meaning of dukkha helps us to understand it and helps us, you know, the first and second point to how we become reactive. But this isn't the deeper meaning of the end of dukkha. And it's very similar for the third meaning of dukkha that we have, which is called sankhara dukkha. And this is about the dukkha that, or let me back up. This is basically saying that any conditioned phenomena, any taste or smell or thought or bodily experience, anything that happens is not capable of giving lasting satisfaction. It's dukkha in that sense, not capable of giving lasting satisfaction. Sometimes you'll see it translated as unsatisfactory. And that's, again, for me, that's a way of pointing to how there can be reactivity, that we take that which is fundamentally incapable of giving lasting satisfaction, we try to get satisfaction out of it. But when there is awakening, that doesn't change either. There's not the end of dukkha in that sense. What there may be the end of is trying to find satisfaction in what can't give satisfaction. But the sankhara dukkha never ends. That doesn't end. So in that sense, the end of dukkha is not about suddenly things that were unsatisfactory changing. No, it's more so in that third sense of dukkha also isn't really what the Buddha's getting at when he talks about the end of dukkha. So what is he getting at? I believe he's getting at reactivity, okay? Where he's pointing to the way that we grasp onto the pleasant and push away the unpleasant, because that is capable of changing. That is something that we can work through. We can transform and end reactivity. You know, again, easier said than done, but a lot of us have been doing that. So here I want to bring in the image, Corey. This is from the model of dependent origination, and this is one way of understanding reactivity. So here we have the middle part, or actually it's of the model of dependent origination, which was the teaching from that the Buddha got from his night of awakening. And here, in this model of 12 different links, we have what are called the 6th through the 9th links, but this is really right at the heart of our practice. And this will give us a pretty clear sense, I think, of what dukkha means as reactivity. The teaching is this: with every sense experience, we have contact between our senses and some object. In other words, we sense something in our body, we hear a sound, we taste something, we smell something, we hear something. And in Buddhist psychology, we also can think something. There, the thinking is the sixth sense. So we can also think, have a thought, or, you know, it would include emotions as well. So this is basically happening all the time. As long as our senses are working, we're always experiencing some sense object. On the basis of that, there is what's called a feeling tone, vedana, with every sense experience. Every sense experience is either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. The vast majority of our sense experiences are more or less in the neutral range. And this isn't sort of three settings. This is more like a spectrum that someone said it goes from agony to ecstasy, and neutral's in the middle. And there can be kind of a more or less neutral range, but the vast majority of our experiences, it might be as many as 98 or 99% of our experiences are relatively neutral, and we don't notice them much. We don't pick up on them much. But some of them are pleasant or unpleasant, and those are the ones we have interest in especially. You know, there can be, again, pleasant body sensation, unpleasant body sensation, pleasant sound, unpleasant sound. Even just tune in right now. Probably you'll notice that most of your experience is relatively neutral. If I tune in right now to my body sensations, I notice that I'm just a little bit stiff, minorly unpleasant sensations in my body from sitting at this chair for a while, but it's pretty close to neutral. You know, and you may tune in and notice, okay, some pleasant experience, some unpleasant experiences, maybe pretty close to the neutral range. You know, I notice also I have this headset on. When I tune in to my sensations in my ears, a little bit unpleasant, but nothing that actually was drawing my attention. But probably at the end of our session at 12:30, I'll experience a little bit of relief when I take the headset off, right? So it may be something like that for you. So that's occurring all the time. Now, when there's not mindfulness and when there's not awakening, there's a tendency for the pleasant feeling tone to lead to craving or wanting, which is tanha in the original language. And there'll be a tendency for the unpleasant to lead to not wanting something. Then, on the basis of that wanting or not wanting, there'll be a tendency to move to from the craving or wanting to move to grasping, and there'll be a tendency for the not wanting to lead to pushing away. And this can happen in all sorts of ways with all the senses. You know, I can have an unpleasant body sensation and just automatically I'll shift my posture. I can have an unpleasant thought or emotion and I can try to say, oh, go away. I can taste some food, really like it, and immediately reach for the next piece. I can have an interaction with someone, person says something I don't like, I immediately react back. So sometimes this process of moving from contact to grasping or pushing away occurs in a split second, automatically. You know, without much awareness. Sometimes it may take a little while. We may, you know, have a pleasant sensation related to food. We may want it. We may kind of have an inner debate. Should I have that extra piece of strawberry pie or not, right? We have an internal debate, right? And so this is how it occurs. So this movement is sometimes automatic, and sometimes it can take a while. We can intervene here with mindfulness, noticing the feeling tone, noticing the craving or wanting, before we move to grasping or pushing away. I would say I'm interpreting grasping or pushing away as reactivity. And then by reactivity, I'm meaning something that's semi-conscious, sometimes automatic. So it doesn't have the same meaning as we sometimes have in English when we sometimes use reaction as synonymous with responsiveness. Here I'm pointing to grasping and pushing away, and this dynamic as the core dynamic of reactivity. We can take the image off the screen now. And so the other teaching where this is brought out is one that I think almost everyone here probably has heard from me before, so I'll be brief with it. But this is the teaching of the two arrows. And this is also a teaching of reactivity, where the Buddha asks, everyone experiences the unpleasant. How does a practitioner differ from a non-practitioner? And he says, yes, everyone at times has unpleasant experiences. He talks mostly in that text. And I think I actually have a quote in the resources list, a quote from that text, and you can also have the reference to that text, which is the Samyutta Nikaya 36.6, so if you want to look it up. And a good place to look it up, if you want to do that, is look it up on the website Access to Insight, if you want to read the whole text. It's just about 3 or 4 pages, sometimes called the two darts. And so here, the Buddha says everyone at times has unpleasant experiences. In that text, he's talking about unpleasant physical experiences, but we can generalize and talk about unpleasant body sensations, unpleasant thoughts, unpleasant emotions, unpleasant interactions. We can be treated unfairly or unjustly. All sorts of unpleasant experience. The Buddha said having that kind of unpleasant experience of any, I would say of any kind, is like being shot by an arrow. This is the first arrow. That is not a problem. We all are sometimes shot by the first arrow. The problem is that on the basis of that unpleasant experience, the Buddha said, we shoot a second arrow as if it would help. And so we're reactive, I would say, to the first arrow. We react in all sorts of ways. I can react to the first arrow by, if it's an unpleasant physical sensation, by tensing, by being tight. You know, if I walk across the room and trip over a shoe that my partner has left out there, I can blame my partner. That's the second arrow. I can judge myself harshly for being not aware. That would be the second arrow. You know, I can react negatively to a person who says something to me. That could be the second arrow. So I'm interpreting that as pretty much the same thing as what we saw on that last chart from this other teaching, dependent origination. That it is basically the semi-conscious or unconscious pushing away of the unpleasant or grasping after the pleasant. The text of the two arrows is primarily about the unpleasant and the pushing away. And so I think that's the same teaching. So I'm interpreting that shooting of the second arrow, I'm calling that reactivity. Because it's clear from the text that what one learns in the second teaching of the two arrows, sometimes called the two darts, is that one can learn when there's something difficult or unpleasant not to shoot the second arrow. In other words, not to be reactive. way easier said than done. And practicing with dukkha, I interpret the most central meaning of dukkha for our practice as reactivity, and I interpret the end of dukkha, which is the aim of all of our practice, as the end of reactivity. Again, simple phrase, simple concept, hard in practice and with a lot of subtleties and complexities in practice. But that's what it's about. It's about learning not to be reactive. Well, how do we get there? How do we practice with dukkha? The first thing is just to notice when it's occurring. And so part of our practice, and this is a beautiful daily life practice, is to set our radar for moments of reactivity. And we'll notice that there are small moments of reactivity and there are big moments of reactivity. What we want to do is to really study our reactivity. Again, many, many ways this can occur. One way is just to notice my primary reactive patterns just in the flow of daily life. That's useful. What are my top five forms of reactivity? What are my top 10? Let me notice reactivity and look to when that happens. So that's one way to practice. Another way to practice is to learn to be with the pleasant or the unpleasant with mindfulness and notice tendencies to be reactive in one of those two ways, to grasp after the pleasant or push away the unpleasant. So you can do this. You can deliberately, during a meal, let's say, when hopefully for most of us they're mostly pleasant sensations, you can just be with the pleasant, try to stay just with the pleasant, and notice if there are tendencies to want or to grasp after. You can do that with other pleasant sensations. Learn how to be with pleasant sensations. I don't know, maybe taking a shower. Part of it is actually saying, let me tune into the pleasant. We don't always do that very much, but we can tune into the pleasant and see if there are tendencies to, again, to want and to grasp. We can do something similar with the unpleasant, which often can be both more difficult and more instructive. Let me back up. I think I told this story in the retreat that I just had. A few of you are from that retreat, but I had a sitting group where we were exploring, I think, some version of this teaching, and I told people, the pleasant is not the problem. Rather, it's the reactivity in relation to the pleasant, that's the problem. And again, maybe to back up and say, choosing to have that second piece of strawberry pie isn't necessarily the problem, if we can do so out of consciousness and clarity, right? And so it's not that we say, I am never going to go towards the pleasant or choose the pleasant. That's not it. But it's rather looking at the reactivity. All the time, we choose to act to move towards the pleasant. You know, if I'm feeling uncomfortable sitting, I take that as a sign and I might shift my posture. What we want to look towards is the automatic quality of it and the reactivity. So one evening in this group, we were discussing this teaching, and I told them, the pleasant isn't the issue, it's the reactivity, the grasping, that's the problem. We could just sit here all evening and eat chocolate together, and that wouldn't be a problem necessarily, right? And they said, let's do it. And so we did it the next week. We could do this at Marin Sangha sometime if you'd like. Everyone brought in chocolate, and we ate chocolate together like for an hour or two. Right? And we got to study what's the experience of the pleasant. and we could watch, are there tendencies towards grasping? When after the first piece of chocolate does the mind say, more, 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 or however it speaks, right? You know, when does it do that? So very interesting exploration, you know? And then we can also notice that actually the pleasant isn't directly and universally connected with a particular object. We know that in relation to food, one person finds broccoli pleasant, another doesn't, right? But even for the same thing, for the same person, one person can find the first piece of chocolate very, very pleasant, and the seventh piece of chocolate not very pleasant, right? Anyone ever experienced that? Okay, right? So that's very interesting, right? And so we can also experience and explore the unpleasant. This can be harder. In meditation, sometimes when you know that, let's say, an unpleasant sensation is not going to cause harm or damage to your body, explore what it's like to stay with the unpleasant. This is actually a big part of our meditation, right? That we sometimes are with the unpleasant, but we can actually do it with that model from dependent origination in mind. Notice when we're with the unpleasant, what your own internal voices say. Are they saying, let's not stay with this? You can notice the voices of not wanting. You can notice that even the almost the body tendencies to push away. So this is another way to practice with reactivity. Study the experience of the unpleasant and the pleasant in our experience. You know? And then sometimes we can also bring this into a larger field of practice. So for example, a lot of what I teach, and especially with my colleague Oren J. Sofer, we teach a lot on wise speech, on learning how to, when there's something difficult happening, how to come from a place of non-reactivity in our speech practice. So this is something we can bring into our relationships, into our speaking. I'm not going to go into detail on that, but that's something that's possible. We can bring non-reactivity into our speech practice, and we can also bring it into how we work in the larger society. I've done some teaching, and I don't know if anyone's been on this. I've done some teaching at Spirit Rock and elsewhere about how this teaching of not shooting the second arrow is very, very close in my mind to the nonviolence of Gandhi and Dr. King, Dorothy Day, and others. They're basically saying we have received painful experiences, oppression, injustice. We will respond very strongly, but we will not, we will not, as it were, be reactive. We will be responsive rather than reactive. We will not simply, as it were, pass on the pain, which is the nature of so many conflicts in the world. We can, we can look at this teaching about dukkha and see that shooting the second arrow is the nature of so many conflicts in the world, so many difficult interpersonal interactions. And so developing non-reactivity in that way is also an application. And the other side of that is we can also see that there's a large amount of social conditioning in which we are conditioned to grasp, or we're conditioned to push away compulsively. You know, and one person who's analyzed this in some depth is my colleague David Loy. I brought in a book. One of the books he does this in is a book called Money, Sex, War, and Karma. And in that book, he analyzes how greed, the wanting, the compulsive wanting, is actually institutionalized. He interprets that it's there in a very strong way in much of our economic system. And I remember reading an account from Wall Street during a major downturn. This wasn't one of the recent ones, but was a few years ago. There was a major downturn on Wall Street, and one of the brokers on Wall Street says, the way we work around here, there are two kinds of cycles. There's a greed cycle and there's a fear cycle. And he said, we're in a fear cycle right now, right? But the point is that grasping can get institutionalized so that we never have enough, you know, so that we always are wanting. You know, and in a similar way, pushing away can get institutionalized. I would say that racism is a form of institutionalized reactivity that gets institutionalized, turned into, you know, has cultural, social expressions, but also gets translated into institutions. So I would say that the end of dukkha as the end of reactivity has social meanings as well, has individual meanings, interpersonal meanings, community meanings, and social meanings. So multiple ways to practice. On an individual level, we can practice in some of those ways that I've mentioned. One more way to practice, and then I think we'll do a little bit of meditation and then have some discussion. One further way to practice that's very interesting is when we notice ourselves sometimes being reactive. Let's say that I notice myself after tripping on the shoe, and maybe let's say I'm judgmental of myself for being clumsy. I'm reactive. One thing we can sometimes do is to trace back on that model of dependent origination from grasping, trace back to what was, in this case, unpleasant. Or I was actually tracing back from the pushing away to what was unpleasant. We go backwards two steps on that model of dependent origination. And I'm wondering, Corey, would it be, maybe we could send out that model to everyone, maybe not instantly, but at your convenience, the model that we showed as a graphic, because that could be useful for everyone. So we will send that via email, that graphic, to everyone, so you have that. But we can sometimes go backwards. We're noticing ourselves being reactive. We can ask ourselves, what was the unpleasant? And we can sometimes tune into the unpleasant, and that can actually work in an amazing way to end the reactivity. We find ourselves judgmental. We tune in, what was unpleasant that preceded my reaction? Let me tune into that. Oh, that didn't feel good to trip, and actually I can still feel it. We stay there for a while. The judgmental activity may dry up. I experienced this once on a retreat where there was a really, really long line because I think they were serving tacos. And I was getting very impatient and I was complaining, why don't they do the tacos line differently? I was getting impatient and I was noticing myself being judgmental of the cooking staff and so forth. And at a certain point, I tuned in and said, let me notice what's there. Let me notice what was unpleasant. And I noticed, and because, you know, when I was being judgmental, I was not at all aware of being impatient. I was just being judgmental, right? I tuned in to what was there, and I noticed, oh, I'm impatient. Let me be with that. And I was hung out with the impatience for a while, which in terms of our model is an experience of the unpleasant. And I noticed that the judgmental mind was drying up. And even after a while, I wasn't impatient. When I actually was mindful of the impatience, my impatience dried up, the reactivity dried up. So that's another very, very interesting technique to work with reactivity. We can go backwards and ask, what's the unpleasant or what's the pleasant experience? Try to tune into that experience. We'll find sometimes that when we do that, the reactivity will dry up. Very, very interesting. Okay? So ready for a short meditation? Okay, let's do that. Then we can have some discussion. Now just coming back first to being present. If it helps you to stabilize, coming to your breath or your body, we'll just do that for a few minutes. Do a few short practices. One of them is to notice any time in the next few minutes when there is a sense, when there's a significant sense of pleasant or unpleasant. Kind of a moderate or stronger sense of pleasant or unpleasant. Might not arise too much. And when that occurs, if and when that occurs, just be aware of what the experience is like of the pleasant or the unpleasant. Notice if there are any tendencies with the pleasant towards wanting and grasping, with the unpleasant towards not wanting and pushing away. So this is to set your radar for the pleasant or unpleasant when it's there in a moderate or stronger level of intensity. And if it occurs, then just to be mindful of the sense of pleasant, noticing anything that arises. So I'll invite that for the next period of time. Another related way to practice is to just tune in right now if there's any predominant sense of pleasant or unpleasant. Especially you might tune in to what's in your body, but also could be a thought or emotion. Like for example, I notice that there's some unpleasant sensation in my around my back and neck right now. See if there's something. It doesn't have to be too large a scale. Mine is such that if I was talking a lot, I probably wouldn't notice it much. But now that I'm not talking, I notice it. And one way to practice is just to let that be the focus of mindfulness. What is the experience of the unpleasant like? What's the experience of the pleasant? And now one further practice. Bring to mind an experience that may have occurred earlier today or maybe yesterday in which there was some reactivity. It could be just on your own, could be being judgmental, or could be anxious, or could be wanting something really strongly, grasping after something. Could be just on your own, could be interpersonal. In terms of a scale of intensity of 1 to 10, have it be somewhat in the middle range, maybe 4 to 7 at the most. So first choose a discrete experience. Could be a difficult interaction with someone where you were a little snappy or something. Could be a difficult physical experience. And then bring that experience to mind as if you're reliving it, maybe for about a minute or so. So we're looking for a fairly brief experience, or one that one could take a brief part of it. Take that experience as if you're reliving it, and see if you can notice what the reactivity is like. What's it feel like in the body? What are the thoughts? What are the emotions? And do that for about a minute or two. Now see if you can be mindful of whatever the reactivity was. Again, could be a reactivity in the body or the mind, emotions. And see if you can see that reactivity, much like in that four-step model, and just ask yourself, is there some pleasant or, for many of us, unpleasant experience that is, as it were, triggering that reactivity? Can I tune in to that unpleasant or pleasant experience connected with the reactivity? And see if you can do that right now. It's going backwards in that model. One technique that can help that is to bring your attention more to your body, to the center of the chest. So now if you can let go of this experience of reactivity, if you want to shake it out a little bit, you can do that. And thank you, and let's come back to the whole group. And we have a little bit of time if there are any observations, questions. So I'm giving the essence. Ideally, we would have, we could take these practices and work with them, you know, over a week, just looking for reactivity in daily life and our meditation, set your radar that way. It's a wonderful daily life practice, really, really workable. Any thoughts, questions, observations? Okay, Vera, I see.
I feel like I had a little mini self-therapy session. So I guess part of the question is if I'm doing this as you have suggested. So I can hear my housemate's shrill, annoying voice through the wall. So I'm going back to my reaction to that,
yeah,
which is annoyance and judgment. And then I go back to, why is that so annoying? And I'm going back to my mother's voice.
Mm-hmm.
So is that, so it's a continual going back?
Yeah. Thanks, Vera. So this is getting into more some of the subtleties and complexities. For the purposes of the practice we just did, it would be just to go back to kind of the more direct experience of not, of it being unpleasant, right? And be with that. One, you know, if we were taking, you know, a whole day on dukkha or a few days on dukkha, one of the things we would want to do is start to look at some of the particular regular patterns or more chronic patterns of dukkha. And then practicing with dukkha or reactivity actually becomes an opportunity to clean up old residual patterns, right? That's potential here. So in that sense, yes, over time, I'm not, you know, going into detail on that. I did do that some. I did a series of talks recently at Spirit Rock of three talks on working with reactivity. And the third talk, I think it would have been just recent, May 27th, I went into detail on this point, right? So you could hear that, get more depth, but the for the purposes, the more simple practice is first just to experience it, to get back to the unpleasant experience. That might link to memories of your mother, but for most of us, it probably would just feel unpleasant. But when we then have looked at it 50 times or 100 times, or we see certain patterns there, or we've done a lot of psychotherapy, right? Then we thought, oh, it's not just simple, right? There's something there. So working with dukkha as reactivity is one of the benefits, is that when we see very common patterns, that's the doorway to cleaning up old residual patterns. And of course, how to do that, there's a whole lot more that could be said. But I think the basic point you're making, I think that's right. But we can't do that just with the simple practice that I gave here. Yeah. Yeah, thanks, Vera. So, Corey and Bill, is that raise hands function working?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, I see Liz.
So, this probably, we don't have enough time and it's not the focus of your practice, of your day. So you notice reactivity, okay, good. then what the heck do you do with it? I think that was maybe Vita brought that up. And you notice the unpleasant, notice how it's feeling, and just throwing in this little short opportunity to practice self-compassion.
Yeah, that's I think the several things we can do. But I like adding the point about holding it all, particularly repetitive patterns or where the reactivity is unpleasant or difficult, but even for where the reactivity is pleasant, because that would be addiction, right? A lot of addiction is mm-hmm. reactivity that is going towards something pleasant. So that can still be have its way of going into the painful. So I think holding this, particularly repetitive patterns, with compassion, with metta, that's a great addition right now. So what do you do with it? There are a number of steps. The first step, and many of us may have already done this a lot, the first step is just to notice what the patterns are, to really have a sense, what are my top five, what are my top 10? So we have to notice. We can also start to be start to bring mindfulness to any sequences related to the pattern. You know, so if I tend to, I'll give an example that is one I use a lot. I once had a role as talking to a person who was in charge of the organization and meeting with him every 2 weeks. I thought, and many people thought, that he was not a good listener. He would frequently, after I had made a point or a suggestion, change the subject. You know, and I would find myself getting very reactive, basically judgmental, and basically emotionally gone, right? I was just gone. I wasn't in the discussion anymore. I was being reactive. And I was stuck in my reactivity, right? And so first step would be noticing that there's reactivity. Noticing reactivity is not the same thing as being stuck in it. So that would be step one. Over time, and I was getting mentored on this as how to approach the situation, over time, after a while I could see, oh, there was a trigger for my reactivity, right? So we can first maybe intellectually know, oh, the trigger was I don't think he listened to me, right? Or we might look at some other sequence and we can understand there was something unpleasant that happened. You know, going back to the model of from contact to grasping or pushing away. So I could go back and I could know that. What I did in later meetings, I tried to be mindful when the unpleasant experience was happening. And when I did that, I started to notice, oh, I feel myself really drawn to being judgmental, but the mindfulness prevented me from going there, and I could actually tune in to what was unpleasant, and I could stay with that. And when I did that, it was painful, but it usually didn't last that long. It prevented me from going into reactivity just to hang out with the unpleasant. And I was often in a place where I could then respond and say, you know, I made an important point. Can we come back to that later? Right? In other words, basically the idea is touching, in this case, the unpleasant, or the example with my impatience, tended to uproot the reactivity. So, or in that moment. Now, Vera's point and my response brought out the point that there often are very long-standing patterns. So I would say that my moment of doing that was a contribution, but it didn't uproot the pattern. It didn't uproot the habit, but it started to do that. So essentially, there are countless forms of reactivity, but the way to work with it is first to be mindful, study the patterns, know what the different patterns are, see the links with the pleasant or the unpleasant, intervene by being aware of the pleasant or unpleasant. Sometimes that will just release. You know, this is the major way I work with the judgmental mind. Sometimes that will release the pattern or release the reactivity temporarily, but if it's a long-standing pattern, the next time something similar happens, it'll come up again, right? So we can work in the moment and release it, but we can also, over time, do that and do other kinds of work with the pattern. So does that start to get at it? I was asking a question. Liz, does that start to get at it some?
Oh.
What?
It doesn't. To me, it's too conceptual. This is all in the head.
Well, I'm giving instructions.
This is my reaction. This is my reaction, that this is too conceptual.
Oh, you mean the reactivity is conceptual?
Yes.
Okay.
For me, you're leaving out the feeling and the pain and what to do with that.
Okay.
Maybe we're just coming from different strong points of view. I would move towards the emotional, while you would move towards the conceptual.
I think that was implicit in what I was saying. So, for example, with my boss, I would try, you know, and you're helping me to add a piece. If the reactivity is very, very conceptual, we don't get at it by staying conceptual. We typically get at it by coming to the body and to the emotions, right? Which is, I think, where you were going. And so one way of doing that is I'm noticing myself reactive. Let me come to, let me come into the experience around the heart and the body. And just notice what's there.
The heart
and the body. And we can stay with it more on a bodily level, which is not always easy if we're very, very conceptual. Yeah. Okay. So that is a very helpful tool if the reactivity is very conceptual, we're caught in a narrative. That the way that we, because the basic formula is, come back to the unpleasant and the pleasant. And typically, it's not an unpleasant thought, but it's something that's more emotional and in the body. And come back and try to experience it there. That will tend to clean up the conceptual reactivity. But we have to often do that over and over again. Like I work with that with the judgmental mind. And I use that as a main tool. We have to come back to that 100,000 times. But yeah, thank you, Liz, for facilitating that. That the basic formula is touch the, you know, for let's say reactivity that's negative, unpleasant, is touch the underlying pain, stay with it. That tends to be healing. That's the formula, right? But we have to be able to do that and go to the body and go to the emotions. Again, maybe we can come back to this because I realize that there's a lot there. We could say more. Okay, I'm noticing we're at 12:30. Looks like I have one hand raised. Is it Babs? Maybe if it's a brief, would you be okay with a brief question and a brief response? If not, we can save it till later.
Okay, whatever.
I'll
just start and tell me if it's too long, and then we'll just cut it off.
If you could try to have your question be in 30 seconds or a minute at the most, that would work.
Okay. I'll try, or else just cut me off. Okay, so I'm wondering, yes, how the mind decides that something's unpleasant, how primal it is really that it's a body sensation first. And I was thinking about your taco thing, and that maybe you were hungry, and that led to the impatience. So that's a body sensation first. Sounds that I might decide are unpleasant is because how it resonates first, which I might not be aware of, in the body, and irritating to the system. So that was great. My question.
Yeah, that's helpful. My sense is that if we look carefully, our sense of, my sense of being on the tacos line, I didn't think, oh, this is unpleasant. It was immediate, right? And so I think most of the examples you gave are not something that we think about and decide it's unpleasant, but it's almost like it's automatic. And then there's some direct experience, and then we start thinking about it, right? And so maybe you were saying the same thing, but I think with those examples, it's like there's an immediate sense, I don't like this.
Yes, I understand that. What I'm asking is if you trace it back, if you could trace that back, would a large extent of these unpleasant experiences be a primal to the body sensation?
Yeah, I think that it's going to be, there are all sorts of different examples. It'd be a mix. But I think that a lot of our experiences of reactivity are virtually immediate and automatic. And what we can do is, like I say, like the examples I gave, my experience with my boss was immediate and automatic. The experience with the tacos was immediate and automatic. What we actually can do is, especially going into the body, is to trace it back to some experience, which often is hidden from us, which was sort of the precipitating unpleasant experience. And I gave examples in those two instances. Yeah. So I think I'm going to leave it there, but we can bring that up further. Thank you. Thank you, Babs. Okay. Thank you. Okay, so it's time for a longer break now. And this will be for some of us for lunch. For some of us who are on the East Coast, something else will be happening. My suggestion is that we take this next time and see if we can apply the teachings and practices about dukkha or reactivity. And again, a lot of this is exploring the mechanisms of the pleasant and unpleasant. So if you're having a meal, explore what that's like. Notice any wanting or not wanting. Notice what the pleasant is like. You can just sit there and say, I'm going to sit in silence and just notice how the pleasant works. Notice how the unpleasant works. Set your radar for any reactivity, great? And then we can actually check in, I think, at the beginning of the next session, which will be at 1:45 Pacific. We can check in and share some of what we've explored, and then we'll go on to the teachings on not self, okay? So again, use this next period as a laboratory for exploring reactivity, okay? So if this was in person, I could hang out some before I had my lunch and hang out and talk with you and answer any things that weren't fully answered. And we'll have to do that psychically or in the next period. Okay, so have a good lunch or break or personal time. Keep the practice going that we've been doing. Okay, so see you in just a little bit. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Bill and Corey, for your support. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.